you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And this topic came to my attention while I was working on research for our recent Harrison Dyer episode. In that episode, we talked about how Dyer's paramour, Waleska Allen, moved to Reno, Nevada in the early 1920s to establish residency so that she could divorce her imaginary husband, Wilfred P. Allen. That's a whole story. If you don't know it, you can go listen to that episode because it's too much to explain in an intro.
It's a whole journey.
And another podcast subject, Hedda Hopper, starred in a movie in 1927 called A Reno Divorce. And all of this has kind of been playing in the background of my brain and going, we should talk about Reno and divorces. Reno and Nevada have long been recognized as divorce friendly. So I got to thinking about how that happened. And the topic that we're talking about today specifically, sort of, we're talking about a lot of it, is divorce ranches, which didn't really come about until after Waleska's time there. There were things like it going on, but they weren't really like pitched as this is a divorce ranch. Divorce ranches sprung up in the 1930s when the state relaxed its laws even further regarding divorce and residency. So today we will talk about the state's relationship with divorce, how it became the divorce capital of the country, and why this unique and controversial style of resort, the divorce ranch, was so popular for several decades and then became obsolete.
So as Holly just mentioned, divorce was part of Nevada's identity well before the 1930s. But it was definitely not the first place in North America to allow or even be known for the availability of divorce in like a legal system context. There was divorce in the colonies. The first was a bigamy case in the Massachusetts colony in 1643. And as the United States was formed and people moved west from the Atlantic coast, the places at the edges of westward expansion tended to be the most hospitable for a legal breakup of a marriage. It's kind of a pattern in social expectations and moving west.
Yeah. In some cases, that was far away from established communities, so it was easy for someone to start a new life. In other ways, it was just a place that was inhospitable, so people were worried about other stuff. If you want to get divorced, go crazy. We really need to make sure that everyone eats enough. It was just not a priority to really be particular and clamped down regarding divorce. So when Nevada became a territory in 1861, it quickly became a divorce haven. Virginia City, which sits to the east of Lake Tahoe's northern shore, became known as the City of Divorces. When Nevada gained statehood in 1864, the state constitution included the same relatively liberal laws regarding divorce that the territory had. It also included the same requirement for residency that the territory had had, which was 6 months.
Because Nevada's legislature was amenable to relatively quick and easy divorces, it, like other territories and states with similar laws, became very attractive to legal firms from the East Coast. Those firms would set up outpost offices in these places so that they could enjoy the steady business of divorce cases. This helped establish the idea of divorce mills. In addition to the legislation that was in place, lawyers in places like New York or Chicago or other big cities would often encourage their clients who were seeking divorce to go to one of the places where it was easier to get one. They'd spend the required amount of time there to declare themselves a resident and then get their divorce. Even with this wait time to establish residency, this often was a much faster process than it would have been back home, as many states had really long waiting periods after filing. When we say it was easier to obtain the divorce, it was a lot easier. In a lot of states, including New York, to get a divorce, you had to have proof that your spouse had committed adultery. Things like cruelty or abuse, they were not enough. Nevada had a lot more ways that you could claim that a divorce was a necessity.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of those in just a bit. But this all quickly led to high-profile people hoping to rapidly move on from unwanted marriages in the state. We'll talk about several of these today, but one of the first was Bertrand Russell's older brother, John Francis Stanley Russell, who was the second Earl Russell. He may be an episode topic in the future. He's quite interesting to me. His divorce saga is long and kind of intense. Both he and his wife, Mabel, wanted out of the marriage, and they found it impossible within the British legal system. For a long time, the two of them pretty much lived separately, and they kept trying through the British courts to gain a divorce without success. But then when Francis fell in love with Molly Somerville, who was also married at the time, he decided that he wanted to hasten a dissolution of his marriage and Molly's. So he and his mistress went to Nevada.
After spending 6 months at Lake Tahoe, Molly and Francis each got divorces from their spouses who were back in England, and then the two of them got married in Reno the next day. These divorces were not going to be recognized as legal in Britain, and both Francis and Molly knew that. But in Francis's case, he was hoping this would create a scenario where his wife, Mabel, could show clear evidence that she had been abandoned by her husband, so their divorce would finally be granted. He even set aside a sum of money for Mabel to keep the whole thing as smooth and simple as possible. That did not work out as planned, though. While Molly's husband had also filed for divorce and they were able to settle this matter uncontested, and while Mabel wanted a divorce as well, Russell was arrested and tried for bigamy.
That is its own whole story about why he was arrested. It was not very common to prosecute bigamy in Britain at the time, but that's a different story for another day. Reno really did become a big destination for would-be divorcees after a woman named Laura Corey spent time there before receiving her divorce from William Ellis Corey, who was president of U.S. Steel Corporation. This was a divorce that William wanted. He had started an affair with an actress named Mabel Gilman, and he wanted to be free to start a life with her. And Corey paid his wife Laura $1 million for a divorce. This was in the early 1900s, so that was a lot of money. And he asked her to travel to Nevada to live for the requisite 6 months at the time to declare residency and file, which she did. And this was another high-profile case that was covered in papers across the country, and it ended up with Laura getting full custody of their son and a whole lot more money. And because this was a very wealthy, stylish family from the United States, it helped create this sort of halo effect around Reno in particular as the place where wealthy and important people would go to get their divorces. Soon, Reno and Nevada overall were the preferred destinations among the options for relatively expedient divorces in the United States.
Divorce tourism grew so rapidly in Reno in the first decade of the 1900s that much of the city was built to accommodate it. What had been a relatively small town of several thousand residents suddenly had a need for housing for this constant influx of not quite permanent residents. This included apartments, hotels, boarding houses, and in some cases, private homes that were rented out by the room or in their entirety. There was also a boom in entertainment venues and restaurants to keep all these newcomers fed and occupied. In the 1920s, dude ranches started to dot the suburban landscape. They would offer a variety of amenities alongside outdoorsy activities like horseback riding and shooting. Most of their visitors were women waiting out this residency rule. All of this led to Reno taking over the nickname of divorce capital of the country. People started referring to the act of going to Nevada for a fresh start as the Reno cure.
That title of divorce capital was not one that everyone who lived in Reno appreciated. And because of ongoing complaints and campaigning from various groups, including churches and women's groups, the length of time required for residency was lengthened in the 19-teens from 6 months to 1 year. This, of course, resulted in fewer divorces, which was the goal of those groups that had been lobbying for this change. But it also meant that the city that had built an economy on wealthy divorce seekers over the prior decade was suddenly left struggling financially because people were not willing to go somewhere for a year the way they would for 6 months. That law was changed back to the 6-month wait period for the economic needs of the state.
The next divorce of the rich and famous to put Reno in national headlines was that of silent film star Mary Pickford. We talked about Pickford in one of our eponymous food episodes when we talked about fettuccine Alfredo. We mentioned that she and Douglas Fairbanks fell in love with the dish on their honeymoon. That marriage happened after Pickford got a quickie Nevada divorce from her first husband, Owen Moore, which she did in 1920.
Nevada also gained a revenue stream from quickie weddings around this time. That started in the late 1920s, because while other states were tightening their laws and establishing things like waiting periods and blood tests before a couple could be married, Nevada required none of that. Still, after the 1929 stock market crash, the revenue from those dropped off along with everything else.
That crash and the depression that followed ushered in the time of the divorce ranch. We will talk about that right after we pause for a sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nevada economics once again led to a shift in residency laws with the hopes that divorce tourism would bring in more cash flow. In 1931, the Great Depression was in full swing, and the state's finances were really hurting. It was harder and harder for people to come up with the money for an extended stay in Reno or elsewhere in the state just to get a divorce. In 1927, the state legislature had already dropped the residency requirement to just 3 months, so it was not as expensive as it had been at 6 months, of course, but there were still far fewer temporary residents patronizing their hotels, their dude ranches, their restaurants, and their speakeasies.
That year, Nevada made two important changes to state law, which were intended to improve the state's finances and lure tourists. The first was the Wide Open Gambling Act, which, as its name suggests, made gambling legal in the state. And the second was that in March of 1931, Nevada opted to shift to a 6-week waiting period for residency, much shorter than the prior 3-month period, and way shorter, way, way shorter than the 1 year that most other states required. It also added wording that a person could ask for a divorce based on what was described as extreme cruelty, entirely mental in nature. That was way easier to claim than adultery or abandonment, which was what was required in other places, and also other places required proof of those claims.
Yeah, that extreme cruelty clause gets discussed a lot in anyone writing about this history, because in some cases it was like not maybe what you would think of as something extremely cruel, but like things like, my husband won't let me play the radio in the house, or like in some cases there was obviously genuine cruelty. I don't want to downplay that, but in some cases they didn't have to really come up with anything heavy to get the divorce moved right through. This shift in divorce laws was recorded in the Nevada legislature as follows. Section 22, divorce from the bonds of matrimony may be obtained by complaint under oath to the district court of any county in which the cause therefore shall have accrued, or in which the defendant shall reside or be found, or in which the plaintiff shall reside, or in which the parties last cohabitated, or if plaintiff shall have resided 6 weeks in the state before suit be brought for the following causes or any other causes provided by law. So first, impotency at the time of marriage continuing to the time of divorce. Second, adultery since the marriage remaining unforgiven. Third, willful desertion at any time of either party by the other for the period of 1 year. Fourth, conviction of a felony or infamous crime. Fifth, habitual gross drunkenness contracted since marriage of either party, which shall incapacitate such party from contributing his or her share to the support of the family. Sixth, extreme cruelty in either party. Seventh, neglect of the husband for the period of 1 year to provide the common necessaries of life when such neglect is not the result of poverty on the part of the husband, which he could not avoid by ordinary industry. Eighth, insanity existing for 2 years prior to the commencement of the action.
That last one had additional language as well, requiring corroborative evidence. We've talked about instances in history on the show where a husband has declared that his wife was insane to try to get a divorce without needing any other verification or examination of that claim. This additional language was there to prevent that kind of situation.
The new version of the Divorce Act went into effect on May 1st, 1931. A reported 300 new divorce cases were filed that morning. But the new law also kicked off a lot of controversy around the United States. there were a number of states, or at least prominent judges within a number of states, that did not want to recognize Nevada divorces as legal because of the looser regulations. Almost immediately, newspapers around the nation included coverage of this issue and featured opinions and statements given by various judges on the matter. Illinois, in particular, was the first to challenge the validity of Nevada divorces. Maryland also would not recognize Nevada divorces initially, and Tennessee was not happy about it, but had not had any cases come up for them to really examine. And then when Georgia authorities were questioned on the matter, they just were not sure if Nevada divorces would stand in their state.
Just a month after the Nevada 6-week residency law went into effect, the Los Angeles Evening Citizen News ran a lengthy editorial on quickie divorces. It read, quote, "Lawyers generally throughout the country know that citizens of one state cannot legally escape the divorce laws of their own state by taking temporary sojourn in another state. Nevada divorces are good only as long as they are accepted by both parties, but let one party to the marriage raise objection in the state in which both parties are residents, and the law will support the objection. Nevada divorces are founded on perjury. Parties to divorce cases in Nevada are asked not only if they are residents of the state, but if they intend to be residents thereof. They always answer in the affirmative, although at the time of the answer, they have their tickets purchased to go back home. The Nevada divorce mill may lead to a national uniform divorce law. Protection of the rights of women and children may require such a step. Nevada's easy divorce laws may be all right in many cases, but perjury is not to be approved, and neglect of the rights of children are not to be approved. Ultimately, Nevada divorces were deemed legal and were upheld by all the other states."
By December of 1931, so the same year this law went into effect, divorce ranches were hitting the papers. Many papers ran a story with the headline, "Divorce Ranch Established at Reno by Vanderbilt for Freedom Seekers. Decree and grand time, all for $500. So this literally was like syndicated in all of the papers. And many instances of this article opened with what amounted to kind of an advertisement for Vanderbilt's new business, which read in part, quote, "No longer need the ordeal of interviewing lawyers, attending courts, and such tiring details prevent the freedom-seeking husband or wife from cutting loose from the unwanted partner. Thanks to Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr., everything is now plain sailing for the one who desires to be rid of the marital shackles. Neely, as he is affectionately called, has opened up a divorce ranch at Indian Springs Oasis near Reno, where all one has to do is check in and spend 6 weeks of entertainment while the management attends to all troublesome details of severing the tie that binds." It goes on to explain that the small charge of $500 covers, quote, "room and board for 6 weeks, plus entertainment, horseback riding, tennis, swimming, and so forth." It also mentions that Vanderbilt has hired a manager named Maury Gracci to handle all of the business, including talking to lawyers for the guests, and that if this venture succeeds, the business will expand into a chain, quote, "within a convenient radius of the divorce mills at Reno." It touts that manager Gracci will, quote, "do 101 of those annoying little jobs that take all the fun out of divorce."
This article was likely the first introduction a lot of readers around the country had to the concept of a resort for getting divorced. And it describes how easy and pleasurable it will be for guests to go on vacation and do all the things they would enjoy in a regular ranch stay, with the added legal benefit of handling the divorce when the stay is over. Vanderbilt is quoted in the article saying, quote, "give the public what it wants, do it cheaply, and with the minimum amount of trouble to the customer." This first ranch was called Lazy Me, and it developed a reputation as a place where not only could a person wait for their divorce, but they could also potentially enjoy a no-strings-attached dalliance with somebody from the staff. Vanderbilt, who was an outcast from high society, got a book out of the business, but it does not appear that he stayed in there.
No, I kept trying to hunt down, like, did he ever open up his chain? He just kind of vanishes from this whole project after a while. After he wrote his book, I think he was, like, done. Most of the divorce ranches in the 1930s were in or around Reno, but that changed at the end of the decade, and we'll talk about why after we hear from the sponsors that keep Stuff You Missed in History Class going.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Prior to 1939, most hopeful divorcees went to Reno. That was where the divorce ranches were mostly clustered. But that year, 1939, Clark Gable's second wife, Maria Franklin Prentice Lucas Langham, who went by Rhea, had a lengthy stay in Las Vegas to establish residency so she could divorce her movie star husband. The couple had gotten married in 1931 when Gable's career in film was just beginning. Rhea was 17 years older than Gable and had just gotten divorced from her third husband when the two met in 1928. Their courtship was one in which the wealthy socialite Rhea took care of the younger Gable financially, helping him develop his stylish image. But as Gable had become a movie star, he had also been seen around Los Angeles with many women who were not Rhea, and many of his co-stars, and it was apparent that this marriage was not a happy one. So Rhea moved to Nevada, but she went, as we said, not to Reno, but to Las Vegas.
She asked only that she be given privacy, and in exchange, she gave an interview to the Las Vegas Review-Journal. This was a deal she arranged with the Las Vegas Chamber of Commerce. That interview was accompanied by photos of Langham having a wonderful time, enjoying a variety of leisure activities, including visiting the casinos of Vegas. And it put Vegas on the map as a divorce resort. Soon, the city had its fair share of divorce ranches. The year after Rhea Langham's stay and endorsement of Las Vegas, the Vegas Strip was added to the city's offerings, and it cemented its place as a destination for weddings, divorces, and gambling.
While divorce ranches appealed to people with enough money to spend $500 to while away their residency requirement, there were also much less glamorous places popping up to serve the needs of the less affluent in Reno and Vegas. These were sometimes dormitory-style boarding houses for women where they would share a room and a bathroom with, you know, anywhere from 4 to 8 people. They were not really having the time of their lives, but they were still getting their divorces and they were still boosting the area's economy. By the end of the 1930s, Nevada was home to 5% of the divorces in the United States. That may not sound like all that much, but its population made up less than 0.1% of the country's total.
There were still plenty of famous and glitzy visitors to the divorce hub of the country over the years. In 1951, Rita Hayworth famously went to Lake Tahoe for 6 weeks to file for divorce from her third husband, Prince Ali Khan. The couple had been together for 2 years when Hayworth left with their toddler daughter to petition for divorce on the grounds of extreme cruelty, entirely mental in nature.
When crooner Eddie Fisher decided to divorce Debbie Reynolds to marry Elizabeth Taylor in a huge scandal that eventually cost him professional opportunities, he went to Vegas to wait out the 6-week waiting period. Fisher combined his Nevada residency accrual with work, and he got a job singing on the Las Vegas Strip at the Tropicana. Elizabeth Taylor was said to have often been at his shows as the pair waited for his divorce.
The culture of these divorce ranches, at whatever economic level a person could afford to stay, was really fascinating. This 6-week stay afforded a variety of experiences for people, and for many of the women who went there, it was a taste of freedom that they really weren't accustomed to. In some cases, divorce ranches offered a sense of community. People were all going through the exact same experience, and there are a number of accounts that mention close friendships that people formed there. For someone who wanted to experience the freedom of a life unhindered by attachment, there were plenty of diversions and places to visit. Some ranches and boarding houses even assisted with childcare for mothers who had arrived with their little ones, enabling mom to have a night on the town whenever she desired.
In 2010, two sisters, Beth Ward and Robbie McBride, shared their story of growing up on a divorce ranch run by their parents for NPR's StoryCorps. One of the things that the sisters mentioned was the fact that their mother would go to court with the women who stayed at their family's ranch, which was Whitney Ranch, and she would testify that that woman had indeed been living with them for the preceding 6 weeks. They were both very adamant that their mother was very adamant that she would never lie. So if a guest asked her to vouch for having seen them and she had not, she would not do it. This practice, though, of an owner, a manager, or employee of a ranch being the person to vouch for a person's resident status was very common practice. Ward and McBride shared stories of guests who were, in some cases, truly heartbroken and cried throughout their stay, as well as people who sometimes brought someone else with them, who they frequently called their cousins. These were usually men that the women involved were intending to be with once their divorce was final. So they would book two rooms, essentially, one for them, one for their cousin, probably had some time for romance in the 6 weeks they were there, and then at the end they could get married.
Although some of these guests were unhappy to be leaving their marriages behind, Ward told StoryCorps, quote, as a whole, most of the people who came there, they wanted a divorce. So it wasn't an unhappy time for them. They just thought it was great that there was someplace they could come to get one. Beth Ward was married herself, and she met her second husband when his wife was at the ranch for a divorce.
I love that little detail. Though one popular image of the divorce ranch is that it was kind of a place where wealthy people played and got into all manner of frivolity of what you might think of as a less than wholesome nature, there were also ranch owners who spoke against that image. In an article in the Nevada State Journal in July 1965, several ranch owners tried to correct some of the information that had become part of the popular lore of divorce ranches. This was actually in direct response to a prior article that was written by journalist Robert Wernick, but this piece overall also sought to dispel a lot of widely held myths about the industry in statements from ranch owners. Those owners were Mrs. L.M. Whitney, Harry Drackert, Mrs. Bertha Winnie, and Hughes Porter. Drackert, incidentally, was happy with Wernick's piece, but that's probably because that original article named Drackert's Donner Trail Ranch as the last divorce ranch in the state at the time, which it absolutely was not. But one point of contention was the insinuation that ranch hands routinely had sexual relationships with guests. Hughes Porter told the paper, quote, "We don't allow them," meaning the Wranglers, "to flirt. We've had the other type of ranch hand. We had to get rid of them."
The divorce ranches continued for decades, although they did wane over time. In 1969, an article ran in the Nevada State Journal under the headline, "Two Divorce Ranches Still Thriving." It calls out specifically the Donner Trail Ranch and Whitney's Guest Ranch and talks about the many ways that these two ranches continue to keep guests happy, busy, and well cared for during their 6 weeks of living in the state. The article notes, quote, "With Reno's reputation as a divorce mill still going full speed ahead at the ranch, the only cloud on the horizon is the proposed dam across the Truckee Stream downriver from the ranch house." That take probably seemed a little quaint just a few months later.
And that's because in 1969, California divorce law shifted in a way that spelled out the end of the divorce ranch. The first no-fault divorce bill, the Family Law Act of 1969, was signed by California Governor Ronald Reagan and went into effect on January 1, 1970. And that signaled the end of the need for divorce ranches. Though there were people getting divorces well before this, this piece of legislation is often considered a big step in destigmatizing it. Kansas and Texas followed with their own no-fault divorce legislation in 1970, and in 1971, Alabama, Florida, New Hampshire, and North Dakota accepted no-fault divorce. Many other states in the time since then. In the space of just a few months, divorce ranches were kind of relegated to the role of an unnecessary relic from a previous legislative age. Almost overnight, Nevada's image seemed to reconfigure itself to be about easy weddings and gambling alone.
You can still visit two divorce ranches, sort of. Two of the places that catered to the divorce set are now inside parks in the Las Vegas area that are open to visitors. Floyd Lamb Park at Tule Springs includes remnants of the Tule Springs Ranch. And Lorenzi Park is home to Twin Lakes Lodge that used to be a regular extended stay stop for divorce seekers.
I am so fascinated by this whole concept.
Mm-hmm.
For so many reasons. And I have so much stuff to say behind the scenes on Friday. Divorce ranches. In the meantime, I have an email that made me squinky a little bit, but also delighted. So here we go. This is from our listener, Whitney, who writes, "Hi, ladies. I've been listening to your show for years, including going through most of the back catalog when I first started listening 5 or 6 years ago. I am a huge history nerd and always include your podcast in my list of favorites." Thank you. "The episode including Sloppy Joe's made me remember a dish my grandmother and mother used to make moons ago called spoon burgers. It seems to be even a step down from Sloppy Joe's in its money-saving status. My grandmother was a child during the Great Depression, and my mother was a child in 1950s Northeast Mississippi, which was definitely a place where the prosperity after World War II arrived late. This version of Sloppy Joe's includes ground beef, a can of Campbell's vegetarian vegetable alphabet soup with ketchup and mustard added for some extra zing." Whitney added a little emoticon face that is exactly the replica of my face. Because this does not sound yummy to me.
I read this email first thing in the morning when I felt like I was still trying to, you know, acclimate myself to being awake for the day. And I was like, oh, no, this is not a combination of things that I'm okay with right now.
No. Whitney continues, "It is served on a bun with yellow mustard. This is a comfort dish from my childhood. However, I can't quite convince my husband to try it. Thank you so much for your wonderful show. I look forward to Mondays and Wednesdays because I know I will have a new episode. I'm attaching a photo of our hound dog mix, Louie, for the pet tax. He is a sassy 2-year-old rescue who is the epitome of a talkative hound dog. I have included a photo of him pretending that we don't feed him." Listen, I don't know. This looks like this dog has never once been fed. He is clearly very, very neglected. And no, Louie is gorgeous. I have a soft spot for hounds. My parents used to breed hounds when I was a kid. So like, show me a hound dog and I'm happy. And he is beautiful. I want to kiss that snoot so hard. I'm kind of with your husband, Whitney. I don't want to eat that either.
Yeah, I think it was the mustard that really tipped me into the being like, mm-mm. And I really like mustard, but something about mustard, in addition to all the other things, why I was like, no, too
it's
much.
It's not that for me. It's the, it's kind of the same problem I have with Sloppy Joe. I'm sure I've talked about it on the show before. I do not like stews generally.
Right.
I don't like gloopy food that combines a lot of other food into some sort of conglomerate. It's just not my thing. So for me, nay. But I'm sure, you know, with the right combo, maybe it is delicious. I might need a couple of cocktails before I eat. I need to like lower my resistance. But I bet Louis would love these.
Yeah.
Because he's never been fed. He's desperate. He's so pretty. I kind of can't get over it. I might have a dog crush on Louis. Whitney, thank you for sharing this story with us. You know, there are lots of foods that we all eat that, especially if they were like a childhood thing, that is not for everybody. And I get it. So please don't think that I'm mocking your childhood comfort food. It just does not sound like something I would love. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of things I eat that other people would be like, ooh, girl, no, thank you. So, no judgment, just not my jam. If you would like to write to us and share your various family recipes that people may or may not enjoy, you can do that. We are at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And if you have not yet subscribed, you can do that on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.